During the Civil War, a pattern had developed within the Union Army. The Army would venture into the Confederate territory. They would suffer a defeat or a stalemate, basically, in battle. Then they would withdraw northward to conduct more marching drills and parades and grand reviews. The pattern changed when President Lincoln put Ulysses S. Grant in charge of the Army. A terrible battle took place in May of 1864 with many, many wounded soldiers burning to death when the forest around them caught fire. The battle itself was a stalemate, but it was so costly that in fear the Army began its retreat. The tired soldiers were slogging along on a rainy night, expecting to withdraw just like they had done early, in fact, just like they had been doing for 3 years since the first battle of Bull Run. It's what they did. They withdrew in fear. But they came to a crossroads, and at the crossroads, they encountered their new commanding general on a horse blocking the road to the north and pointing the army southward. And from that time on, the Union Army never retreated, always further into battle, and within less than a year, General Lee surrendered in April of 1865. Fear leads us to pull back, to retreat. But a true leader is always calling us into battle. And the church exists for battle, not for retreat. Jesus, in Luke chapter 5, is calling his disciples into battle. They've been avoiding the commitment. Do you ever avoid commitment? They had been avoiding the commitment while retreating into the business they knew, which was fishing. They had a bit fishing business. They didn't reject Jesus. They didn't say, "We don't believe in you." They just remained on the sidelines and listened and helped a little. We do the same today. But our fears turn to faith as we come to know Jesus, who calls us into his service. He's in his second year of ministry by this point, even though it's only Luke 5. And there are four steps that need to happen to turn our hearts, our fears, into faith. Step number one this morning, Jesus inserts himself into our everyday lives. Look at Luke chapter 5, verse 1. "Now it happened that while the crowd was pressing around him, listening to the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret," this is the Sea of Galilee, "and he saw two boats lying at the edge of the lake. But the fishermen had gotten out of them and were washing their nets. And he got into one of them, which was Simon's," this is Peter's boat, "asked him to put out a little way from the land, and he sat down and he began teaching the people from the boat." Now just south of Capernaum is the tiny village of Tabqa, where historians believe Peter, James, and John ran their fishing business from the shore here. It's the probable location where some of the most important encounters took place between Jesus and Peter. You remember that at the end, in John chapter 21, there is a similar story, fishing story, where Jesus encounters Peter in very similar circumstances, same place. Same place. This is where these encounters took place. As here, first time, Jesus is calling Peter into ministry. Later, after the resurrection, he recalls him into ministry. The little church you see in the picture is called the Church of the Primacy of Peter because it commemorates Christ's call on Peter's life. Let me set the stage here for a minute for what happens in Luke 5, because we read this story and we read it as if it was Jesus calling them sort of out of the blue. just an all of a sudden kind of experience. And that's not the case at all. This is probably at least the third encounter that Peter has had with Jesus, and the fourth that John has had with Jesus, maybe more. They had served Jesus actually before this. John was probably one of the two disciples in John chapter 1 that was a disciple of John the Baptist, who at the baptism of Jesus then left John the Baptist and started following Jesus back then. That's over a year plus before this event here. Peter and Andrew, James and John were later called by Jesus directly into his discipleship to follow him in Matthew chapter 4. That is also sometime before this. Then Peter hosted Jesus. We looked at that in Luke chapter 4. Hosted him in his home. Remember, his mother-in-law was sick, and Jesus healed his mother-in-law and served the people there out of Peter's home. Each time the men would see Jesus, be called by Jesus, and return to their fishing business, to what they knew. They've been called by Jesus. They admire Jesus. But they're not yet ready to follow Jesus. And there's a huge difference. They will go and listen to him. They will even serve him briefly. And then return to their boats and to their nets. That's the pattern of these early gospel encounters. Now, once again, they are back to their fishing business. Fishermen worked all night. That was their schedule. They worked all night long. They used drag nets that were 100 feet long. They would pull them between two boats and drag the bottom of the Sea of Galilee. And then they would haul them up. It was back-breaking work. And then they would empty the fish, and then they would put the nets down again, and they'd drag the bottom of the Sea of Galilee. When the sun came up in the morning, the fishing was done. They would beach their boats on the shore, and they would eat breakfast, take care of the fish, mend the nets, do whatever they had to do. It is at this point, when they have worked all night, beached their boats, doing their final business before they went home to go to bed. They haven't slept all night. But here is Jesus. What's he doing? He's breaking into their world with a whole crowd of people on the shore where their business is run. New American Standard starts out with verse 1, "Now it happened." Do you suppose it just happened that Jesus picked that spot, that beach, in order to draw a large crowd of people? Do you suppose it was just by chance? I don't think so. He's been after Peter and Andrew and James and John for over a year now. And he shows up. Basically, he shows up at the office. He shows up in their business and says, "Okay, you're avoiding me, I'll come to you." And he asks them to put the boat out in the water. And then he sits in the boat and he can preach. That becomes his pulpit. Nice resounding sound from the water, so he can speak to a larger crowd there on the shore. I'll bet Peter is dozing in the boat while Jesus talks. It has been a long, hard night. But he admires Jesus, and he wants to help him in his mission, so he lets him use his boat. Peter is an admirer of Jesus, even a helper, but he's not a follower. He will be by the end of the passage we're looking at this morning. The same can be said for many Christians today. We admire Jesus. We go to church. We even do things for Jesus. But Jesus doesn't have our hearts. We are not following him with our lives. The Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard put it this way: if you have any knowledge at all of human nature, you know that those who only admire the truth will, when danger appears, become traitors. The admirer is infatuated with the false security of greatness, but if there's any inconvenience or trouble, he pulls back. Christ, however, never asked for admirers, worshipers, or adherents. He consistently spoke of followers and disciples. So here's Jesus. He inserts himself into our world of family, into our world of business, into our neighborhoods, into our lives, and he calls us not to be admirers, but to be followers, to be disciples, to be learners. Not merely admirers of him. That is step number one in the faith sequence. Step number two, Jesus tells us then to do something that makes no sense. Jesus tells us to do something that makes no sense. Verse 4. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered and said, "Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I will do as you say and let down the nets." When they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish, and their nets began to break. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat, which would have been James and John, for them to come and help them. And then they came and filled both of their boats so that they began to sink. Here's a picture of what is called today Peter's Fish. They sell it in the restaurants there. We ate at a nice little restaurant. We were there at the beach in Tobka. We were in Capernaum. We ate at this nice little restaurant. And I had to order Peter's Fish. You can't eat in a restaurant on the Sea of Galilee and not order Peter's Fish. As you can see, I enjoyed my dinner. Jesus tells Peter to put out into the deep water and let down your nets again. Now, Peter's a fisherman. This is what he's done his whole life. This is his business. He's an expert. It's his trade. Jesus, he's a carpenter. He's not a fisherman. What does a carpenter know about fishing? They had fished all night, caught nothing. Now, all fishermen, we got a few in our congregation, all fishermen know the best places to fish, and the best times to do the fishing, and all of that. And this was none of that. Peter knew that the middle of the day in the wrong spot on the lake was the worst idea he'd heard that morning. He was also tired. He was ready to go home and go to bed. But I like Peter. This is the beauty of Peter, isn't it? He's like us. I like him because he objects, but then he says, "Okay, Lord, okay, Jesus." I'm sure he's thinking in his head, "You're going to be embarrassed by this request. I know what I'm doing. I know how to do this business of fishing, and this makes no sense at all." You see, Jesus tends to interact with us in the place we consider ourselves to be the most knowledgeable, to be the experts, you know. Because he's going to show us something in this process. And a miracle happens. The net is so full of fish that Peter has to signal to his buddies to come. And together the boats are filled up with fish till they're almost sinking as they come to shore. Now, Jesus likes to do exactly the same thing in your life and in mine. He asks us to hand over the remote control of our lives. Give it to me. Stop trying to control it all. He enters our world precisely where we think we know what we're doing. "I got this, God. I got this. You don't have to take it. I can handle it." And that's where he enters our world. It might be our family. It might be our business. But whatever it is we consider ourselves, pretty knowledgeable about this. We know the idea that Jesus suggests that we do it doesn't make sense. We object. "Forget it, Jesus. You don't know what you're asking. I can't do that. That doesn't make sense." And Jesus pushes our limits. He makes us step out on a limb. Sometimes just a little limb. Maybe that's as far as he can get us to go at the time. But it's a limb nevertheless. We have to step out to trust him in something. And then he calls us to do the hard things. And then he shows us how he turns the hard things into the good things. Because that's what Jesus does. Author and pastor Dr. John Stott, you've probably read some of his books, longtime teacher, writer, speaker. He passed away in 2011. And on his deathbed, just before he passed away, he gave a very short piece of advice to his personal assistant who cared for him throughout those years. And his advice was this. It was four words. Do the hard thing. Do the hard thing. Just before he passed away. Stott believed that choosing the easy trail, the road most taken, the path of least resistance, can only end up in mediocrity, even if it comes with praise. Do the hard thing. We must not fear doing the hard thing, because it is in the hard thing that Jesus shows us his power, and we learn to trust him in the hard thing. So what is Jesus asking you to do that seems crazy? Seems nuts. It makes no sense. Are you willing to do it for Jesus? Some little step that you need to take? Maybe it's a job change, but it challenges your sense of security. Maybe it's a move. Maybe it's stepping out and investing your time in service for Jesus in some way that seems risky. What about us as a church? Good question to ask ourselves corporately. Are we willing to try new ideas to follow Jesus more effectively in our world? Or are we stuck in the way we've always done it and are unwilling to change? Jesus tells us to do things sometimes that make no sense. And we object. We don't want to do it. And then he shows us in his power how he can work when we do them. Don't be afraid of the hard things, of the changes, of the adjustments, of the things we have to do as we follow Jesus, because it is a dynamic process, constantly growing, constantly learning. That's what it means to be a disciple, a follower, not just an admirer of Jesus Christ. So that's faith step number two. Faith step number three. Jesus calls us to trust his power to provide. Verse 8. But when Simon Peter saw that is all the fish, and they got to shore, he fell down at Jesus' feet, saying, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." Now he's calling him Lord, you see, not just master. Something's changed. For amazement had seized him and all his companions because of the catch of fish which they had taken. And so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not fear. From now on you will be catching men." When they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. Here are a couple of followers of Jesus on the Sea of Galilee. I think you know a couple of them, right? We enjoyed a wonderful time of worship. We took this boat trip across the Sea of Galilee from Tiberias and ended up near Capernaum. Had a wonderful time of worship on the boat. Roger was playing his guitar, but then the boat captain, I guess, was leading us in a concert of praise to Jesus. It was a wonderful time on that boat on the Sea of Galilee. Here's the group on the shore where Peter and his friends met Jesus that day so long ago. Shoreline, of course, has changed quite a bit since those days. Sea of Galilee has dropped significantly in size as they drain water away to irrigate parts of Israel, so it's really the shoreline was much farther, but the water line was much closer in those days. But this is the shoreline where Jesus met Peter. Peter's overwhelmed. His first thought was to tell Jesus, "Get out of here. I don't want you." He knew he was unworthy in his presence. Peter knew fishing, and this was not fishing. This was a miracle. This doesn't happen. You just entered my world, and I know my world, and I am overwhelmed now because this is not normal, and you must be Lord God to do this. This was a miracle. It proved Jesus' identity to Peter. He knew he was in the presence of God now. And when we come face to face with God, we see our own unworthiness, our own sinfulness. We see our sin. What is sin? Sin is simply anything that falls short of God's holy character and nature, His perfection. And our first inclination is to ask God to get out of our lives in that situation. I don't want this. If you've ever been around real evangelism, and I don't mean the kind that often goes under the rubric of evangelism today, which is basically about making Jesus palatable to everybody. That's not what we have here. If you've ever been in the midst of real evangelism, where God encounters a person supernaturally and spiritually to transform their lives, what's the first inclination? Whoa. I don't want you. That's very common. When we come face to face with the real Jesus, we fall on our knees. We are terrified of His power, His holiness. We are unworthy. We are ugly. We are sinful. And we instinctively know something. We know that if Jesus is who He says He is, then we don't want Him in our lives because it's going to change everything. It's going to change us. We will never be the same again. We're going to have to let go of all the baggage that we've clung to if Jesus is who He says He is. So Peter's response is our response too. Jesus, please, no. Leave me alone. I know that I'll never be the same again if you were in my life, so I'm going to fight that. I want to hang on to the stuff of my life. I want to keep what I have. And Jesus says, no, let it go. Give it to me. In that battle, that's the battle of coming to Jesus or not. Because you know that if you're going to come to Jesus, you're going to give it to Him. You're going to let it go. And He's going to change you forever. Jesus doesn't come into our lives to make us feel comfortable. He comes into our lives to call us to follow Him. Following Jesus is not easy. It's hard. And we will be afraid. Jesus tells Peter, don't be afraid. I'm calling you to follow me. And yes, it will be hard. And there will be changes in your life. And there will be things that are not easy. But you can trust me. From now on, Peter, you will catch men, not fish. The word translated catching here literally means to catch alive, to capture alive. Jesus is saying, you will be capturing men alive for me. That's what God calls us to do. He calls us to catch men and women, boys and girls. He calls us to catch them alive for Him. Now this is then the critical turning point for Peter and Andrew, James and John. From this point on, they have a choice to make. Before this, he's called, they've gone, they've followed, gone back. He's called, they've followed, gone back. Now everything's going to be different. You're going to become a follower of me, Jesus says. And that changes everything. They put their fears aside, they serve him. You know, Jesus brings us to those turning points in our lives too. Think back over your life if you as a follower of Jesus now. There was a point where you had to come to that decision. I'm going to follow him. Actually, we're faced with that decision multiple times in one sense because we're always growing in that process. But the question is, at that turning point, will we follow him? Will we trust his power to provide for us and for our families? I mean, these men all had families. This was their business. This is how they paid. That's how they made a living. They were businessmen, not just fishermen. And who's going to take care of my family if I follow you, Jesus? Jesus is telling them to trust him. Not just for themselves, but for their families too. And I don't know about you, but I find it harder to trust Jesus for my family than I do for me. Why the big haul of fish? Well, obviously, one reason, one level, it was to show God's power to Peter. But was it just to show Peter his power? I don't think so. I think it was to show Peter his provision. His provision for his family. They didn't throw those fish away. That was their business. They knew what to do with a big catch, and they did it. The haul of fish would have been collected and sold. The business was doing better than it had ever done. That was the biggest catch they'd had. They made more money that day than they'd ever made in a day. Zebedee, the father of James and John, could run the business. He'd done it before. They didn't have to be afraid that God would not take care of their loved ones. Sometimes God has to show us not just his power, but his provision. He can provide. He can take care of you. He can take care of your family. We have to trust that God can provide for us and for our families. That's not easy to accept. That's tough. I know, because I think about these things too. I understand the struggle to let God have the control. And God has to show me that he can provide too. The wonderful thing about God is that he graciously reassures us. I can take care of you. And at each step of faith, we learn to trust him more with those we love. He reassures us of his provision. He has the resources to take care of you. Sometimes God has to show us that, and he does it by giving us glimpses every now and then of his provision. Fred and Cheryl went to Haiti 25 years ago to pick up a child they had adopted out of the country. Addie was 5 years old at the time. Her parents had been killed in a traffic accident that left her without a family. And as they walked across the tarmac to the airplane that would fly them back to Arizona, as they walked across that tarmac, the little 5-year-old Addie put her hands into their hands in a statement of trust. These people she'd never met before. And it moved their hearts that she would trust them that much. That evening, back home in Arizona, they sat down to their first supper together with their new daughter. They had two teenage sons. The table was filled with food. And they prayed and they started eating, and those teenagers went after that food like nobody's business, and it started disappearing faster. And little Addie just sat there, eyes as big as saucers, looking at the food disappearing from the table, not eating a thing. And Cheryl said she realized at that moment that something was going on in that little girl's mind. She had never seen food like that. And her experience was with food was when it was gone from the table, it was gone. There was no more to eat. She didn't know if there would be any left the next day, because that's the way she'd lived. And so Cheryl said she decided, I've got to do something. So she got up, she took Addie's hand, and she took her over in the kitchen to the bread bin. She pulled out the drawer, she showed her three more loaves. Took her to the refrigerator, opened the refrigerator, showed her all the food there. Took her to the pantry and showed her the food that was stocked in the pantry. To the freezer, taking out food. She didn't just tell her, she showed her. There was plenty. She even named things. She'd put them in Addie's hands and she'd look at them as they put them back. And then she went back to the table. And she could eat. What had happened? She had showed her that the food was there, whether she could see it or not. The resources were available. You know what? God does that in our lives. God does that in our lives. He takes the time to show us every once in a while, look, you can't see it, but my resources are infinite. It's not just my power, it's my provision. It's all there for you. And I can take care of you. You don't need to be afraid. That is step number three in our journey. Step number four, Jesus shows us his power as we follow him. Verse 12. So they leave everything, they follow him. And immediately they head out into ministry. While he was in one of the cities, behold, there was a man covered with leprosy, full of leprosy, the text says. And when he saw Jesus, he fell on his face and implored him, saying, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Because in those days, that was the critical feature. It wasn't just healing. Of course, healing would make him clean, but it was being ceremonially clean so he could be restored to his family and friends and to life. And he stretched out his hand, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, I am willing, be cleansed. And immediately the leprosy left him, and he ordered him to tell no one, but go and show yourself to the priest and make an offering for your cleansing, just as Moses commanded, as a testimony to them. By the way, it would take 7 days of offerings, is the custom. A process where they proved that he was free of leprosy. But the news about him was spreading even farther, and large crowds were gathering to hear him and to be healed of their sicknesses. But Jesus himself would often slip away to the wilderness and pray. I like the words by the New York Times columnist David Brooks. He says, commencement speakers are always telling young people to follow their passions, be true to yourself. This is a vision of life that begins with self and ends with self. But people on the road to character growth do not find their vocations by asking, what do I want from life? They ask, what is life asking of me? How can I match my intrinsic talent with one of the world's deep needs? Jesus calls us to follow him not because it meets our need. It does meet our need. But because he's calling us to meet the world's needs. The first thing Jesus does with these brand new disciples is he shows them the great needs of the world. And that's what he does in our lives too. The needs he came to reach. He leads us to see the world as he sees the world. So the disciples start following Jesus, and immediately they're faced with a man full of leprosy. Now, the text full of leprosy is an interesting phrase. That's not usually how it's referred. It means, basically, that the man was so far gone in his leprosy that his appendages, his face, were all eaten away. Gone. Probably no nose, no facial features, ears gone, fingers gone, toes gone. This is one disgusting-looking person coming up to Jesus. We know now that leprosy, of course, doesn't do that to someone. What happens in leprosy is it's a disease that makes you not able to feel any pain. Pain is actually God's gift to us. When you can't feel pain, then what happens is you don't know that your hand's in the fire burning up. You don't know when your feet are ripped apart by the rocks or your fingers have been smashed. And so infection sets in and eats away at the flesh and destroys the person slowly over time. And they lose various parts of their body. It's a mess. Totally disfigured. And lepers were required to walk around shouting, "Unclean, unclean, unclean." Nobody was supposed to touch them, because if you touched a leper, you were unclean. So what does Jesus do? He touches him. He reaches out and touches him. Now, think about it for a minute. This poor man has probably not had a hug from his wife in years. He probably hasn't had his children free to hold his hand in forever, it seems. Nobody could touch him. He hasn't had the loving touch of anyone for a long time, because he's full of leprosy. He's been going on for a long time. And Jesus reaches out and touches him. What's he saying? Follow me and love these people. Follow me and touch them where they are, in their misery, in their ugliness, in their sin, in their brokenness. Now, Jesus would immediately be unclean himself now. Except that, he's going to make him clean. And he performs the miracle. He's showing the disciples here, in this very first episode, he's showing them his mission. Jesus came to seek and to save those who were lost, broken, shattered, miserable. He came to love people, and he calls us to do the same. And he shows us his way in these verses. He shows us his power to change lives, and he says, "Follow me. You can trust me. I will take care of you. You be about my mission." And that's what the church is called to do. Francis Chan tells a story of a couple named Dave and Lynn Phillips. Years ago, Dave Phillips talked with his wife about sensing this calling of God. And they both sensed a calling of God, felt God was stirring in them to bring relief to suffering people in the world, particularly children, bring relief to children and reach the next generation with the gospel. The thought of starting a relief agency was considered, but they didn't want to leave their jobs. It was asking an awful lot, and Dave was terrified because he hated standing up in front of anybody and talking. He was a behind-the-scenes kind of guy. But after much prayer, they decided to set aside their fears, and Dave and Lynn started the Children's Hunger Fund. It was launched in January of 1992. He received a call from the director of a cancer treatment center in Honduras about 6 weeks after they launched the new venture. The man was asking if there was any way he could get a hold of a certain drug for 7 children who would die without this treatment, without this drug. Dave wrote down the name of the drug. He said, I don't know. I don't know how we get this sort of thing. I don't know where to go and what to do, but I'll see what I can do. He wrote it down, and he and the director of the Honduras Center spent some time praying on the phone. He hung up the phone, and before he could even take his hand off the phone, it was ringing again. And he picked it up, and it was a pharmaceutical company in New Jersey, asking Dave if he would have any use for 48,000 vials of that exact drug. He hasn't even barely hung up the phone. He said, sure. Not only that, they said, we'll airlift it anywhere in the world that you want it to go. And so, the children in Honduras and 20 other sites were served by $8 million worth of drugs given. They found out later that it was one of only two companies in the entire United States that even made the drug. What can God do? Since then, God continues to provide year after year, but that validated. He knew that God was behind this when that happened. I looked it up. You can too. Children's Hunger Fund. Look, you can Google it. They've given out, I think, close to $1 billion worth of aid now over the years, food and other relief to more than 10 million kids in 70 countries, 32 states. They've distributed more than 150 million pounds of food and 110 million toys to people around this world. They stepped out. God validated that and reassured their fears that he could provide. And God is being honored. Jesus can do it. The question is, will we follow him? That's really the only question there is. Will I follow him? Will you follow him? Father, it's easy to say we're yours until you shake things up and you ask us to do something that's uncomfortable. Lord, take us and use us this week. Move in our hearts to serve you with our lives, with our gifts, and be glorified in all that we do. Continue to teach us to trust you and your provision for our lives, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.